little bit of thank you before we start the episode. Late last year, Karen talked me into adding Patreon to Monster Talk as a way of letting listeners show support for the show. At the time, I wasn't sure I wanted to even bother with it because I was concerned about it turning what's a labor of love into a business. Not that there's anything wrong with business. I'm definitely in favor of being paid for one's work. But I wanted the show to be free, and I'm one of those people who gets annoyed by commercials. But we put in the Patreon account, and people actually started to support us with tips and recurring donations. And it's a really nifty system. I like it. But I was thinking it was going to be for coffee money or maybe to buy a book or DVD here and there. And it turns out that over the past 2 months, both Karen and I have had some very interesting challenges in our life. And it turns out that the support of those Patreon donations seriously helped make that a little less painful. We are grateful for those donations. And I'm not using this to beg for everybody to sign up for it. I just wanted to say thank you very clearly and sincerely to the people who donated to us, because we both appreciate your support for the show, and you helped make Karen and my life a little bit easier with your generosity, especially over here at Team Smith headquarters. Okay, from here on out, it'll be nice and lighthearted for the rest of the show. Wait. Actually, we're going to be talking about animal mutilations and horrible, disgusting stuff to do with monsters and dead livestock. Huh. Do you still call it livestock if it's dead? Is that an oxymoron? Oh, is it an oxymoron?
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Monster Talk is the science show about monsters. In this episode, we'll be talking to Colin Schneider, a.k.a. the Crypto Kid, who I met recently at CryptidCon in Kentucky. Hopefully, we'll be having some more interviews with people I met there and get some good classic cryptid monster content. But as I mentioned in a recent episode, I'm also anxious to work on my series on magic, and we'll be getting that going in our next two episodes as we tackle grimoires. But for now, it's time for some good old classic
Monster Talk.
Colin Schneider is one of the youngest active Floridian and cryptozoology researchers in the United States. He's now 17 years old, but he's been doing this, what, since you were 16?
Since I was 11.
Since you were 11, so quite a few years. And he's been involved in cryptozoology and ufology since he was 13, after he visited the International Cryptozoology Museum in Portland, Maine. Salute there to
Lauren Coleman.
Lauren Coleman. Oh, my God. Lauren, I'm so sorry. I'm going to edit that out because I just had a brain fart. Colin, here's another piece of advice. Never turn 40. It's all downhill after that. So, a frequent attendee of conferences at About the Unexplained, Colin lectures at numerous events around the Ohio and Pennsylvania area. He's also a regional representative for the Center for Floridian Zoology and the host of the Crypto Kid radio show on WCJV, Digital Broadcasting Network. And you can listen to that on Monday nights. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. And before we actually started this interview, you mentioned that you were working with the CFZ to increase teen outreach. So we'll talk about that a little bit. But I'm going to let Karen kick off the questions while I try to recover my ability to speak English.
Well, welcome to the show, Colin.
Well, thanks for having me. It's been a goal of mine to come on the show for a while.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you. And we're just very curious to find out how you got interested in this field at such a young age.
Every interview I do about this, I always kind of have a different answer, and it's a whole bunch of things. Goosebumps, the book series by R.L. Stine, was definitely a big influence in my interest in this stuff. And but directly, the first thing I really heard about cryptozoology from was Monster Quest, History Channel's show about, oh gosh, it's almost 10 years ago now that it started airing.
Yeah, it slightly predates our show because it was definitely an inspiration. Yeah.
The first episode I ever saw was on the Ohio Grassman, and it terrified me because they portrayed this Bigfoot creature as being hyper-aggressive, and it was literally in my own backyard. Because I live in Ohio, so it was like an eight-year-old watching this thing about this giant ape creature that according to old newspaper stories, literally ripped a person off of a off of his horse and killed him. Like, that's not that's scary. And so because it was scary, it interested me, and I just started looking more and more into this stuff. And every episode pretty much had Lauren Coleman on it.
It did. Wearing the same shirt. So it's like, I mean, I'm joking, but I've talked to him about that. They brought him up for like one day and then filmed like everything, right?
That's how it works.
Lauren always seemed like just this very knowledgeable grandfatherly figure that I just kind of idolized him as a kid, and I bought almost all of his books as soon as I could, as soon as I got the money. And as you mentioned at the beginning, I got a chance when I was 13 to go to the International Cryptozoology Museum, and I remember walking out after meeting him and buying every book in the gift shop, walking out with a stack of books. All of my vacation money spent before we even got to the place where we were actually staying, thinking, I want to do this for the rest of my life. I want to be a monster hunter. I want to look for these things. And I haven't looked back since.
That's neat. You know, fantastic. We were just doing a multi-part episode on the Kentucky Goblins case, the Kelly Hopkinsville Goblins. And in that document, which was by Blecker and Davis, or Davis and Blecker, they mention Lauren Coleman as part of some of the research. I think we're just talking about the Evansville sort of fishman attack. And I thought, my gosh, Lauren's been around forever. I mean, he's really managed to take up that role of sort of he took the torch sort of from John Keel. Maybe from Ivan Sanderson, you know, that sort of.
He was around during John Keel's heyday.
Yeah, and I think I want to believe, if I remember correctly, that he was actually like helping out Sanderson maybe at one point. I think
Sanderson and Hoovelmans and Coleman all had they sent letters to each other. They were they worked together on different projects. I remember in several books, Lauren said that Sanderson called him his man in the West.
That's nice. But it's fine because we kind of end up doing the same sort of thing now. We typically do it through email and, you know,
right.
Facebook groups and other things. But it is really fun to collaborate on research across the country or across the world. I mean, I think one of my first collaborative projects was done with Kylie Sturgis, and she was in Australia, and I was in Colorado at the time we were working on it. I was at the Stanley Hotel. So I was in the Stanley Hotel researching a ghost case, and Kylie was on the ground doing field work for me. It was awesome. Or with me. I shouldn't say for me. Mm-hmm. It was nice cooperation across the world. So I love it. I love collaboration, and I think that's great that it's existed all this time. So
yeah, well, it helps you to, I think, just take on different perspectives. And if you just work on something yourself, you can get a bit of tunnel vision.
Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Also helps to be that voice of sanity if you're going down a rabbit hole.
So, yes.
Yeah. Unless you intend to be going down a rabbit hole. So, yeah, that's slightly different.
Do you work by yourself, Colin, or do you work with a team of others or colleagues?
I work pretty closely with a couple different people, and I am... Anymore, I'm one of the major movers and shakers in the Center for Freudian Zoology, which is the largest cryptozoological organization in the world, which I will continue to flaunt because I love the group, and I think that not only are we the biggest, but we're the best. Working with John Downs, who is the director, has just been amazing. He was, along with Coleman, one of my childhood heroes. And now I talk to him basically every day, and not just about cryptozoology, but we've become friends. We just chat about, you know, Star Trek and life and universe and everything. And it's just absolutely amazing to me that someone that I grew up watching that influenced how I think about things and how I look at things and where my life has gone can be a close friend of mine. And that's honestly one of the reasons that I do this, as well as my love for the subject, is because I get to work with people that I've lived my entire life looking up to.
Was it difficult to get involved with them? Did you feel like you had challenges?
Oh, no.
No, even with your young age, it wasn't a problem?
John is one of the few major cryptozoologists in the field that is like anyone can go up to him about anything and he will immediately like pay attention to you and only you and discuss whatever you need. I remember when I first got involved, I was with the CFC, I was about 14 and I was really nervous when I first asked him a question because for the longest time I was just working with the guy in charge of the US division, which is a guy named Ronan Colan. Who lives in Ireland.
That's a cool name.
he's a very nice guy, but he's very professional. And I am professional, but I also like to joke around about things.
Sure.
And I was worried that when I contacted John about something or other, I don't even remember what it was. I was worried that just that type of thing would get him to be a little standoffish, and I didn't want it to be like that. But I sent him a message on Facebook because that's honestly the easiest way to get in touch with him. And he immediately replied back, and we just started chatting. And within 6 months, he started pushing me to write an article for the journal. And it was the easiest thing in the world to get involved with the CFC, to be honest. You join and someone will get in touch with you, ask if you just are interested in learning or do you want to work with people and work on research. And if you do, the people that work in the CFC are honestly some of the nicest people I've ever worked with in this field. I've worked with quite a few.
That's great. Mm-hmm. So what sort of things are you working on? I mean, I know a little bit about what you've worked on because of your presentation at a CryptidCon. But like, just what's day in the life of a 40N/ cryptozoology researcher like for you?
Well, I really have three major things I do on a monthly basis. I'm working on a book concerning the topic for my lecture at CryptidCon, which is looking at cryptid attacks on livestock. Because there's a lot of weird aspects to it and something that's not really discussed much. And that takes up a lot of my time. One of the other major projects that I've been working on is I've been working with the CFC on something we call the Next Generation Initiative. And it's kind of like an outreach program and a community for young cryptozoologists or young people interested in working in cryptozoology to kind of help them along and have a community where they can work with other people their age to really learn and become better researchers. Is it something that doesn't really exist? And there are quite a few of us around. We're just not out there and doing much because it is really difficult to get into that position. And then the final thing that I do is work on kind of branding myself, if you will. And that really just covers doing lectures, writing articles. I've been published 16 times, and then just doing my radio show once a week.
So humble self-promotion.
Well, I think it's important.
Look, I'm a guy with a podcast. Of course it's important. It's critical.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Especially for a young person to, you know, be able to say, well, I've been published. I do this, this, and this. I reach out and I do things. Because there are a lot of young researchers that are doing some phenomenal work, but they aren't public about it. And they aren't visible about it. They aren't seen. So they're not thought of. And it can be really difficult, even though you may have some of the greatest research around, it can be really difficult to break into the field if you aren't from the beginning working on getting published and building those connections.
That's actually really a really good point. I think we've actually talked about this on a few episodes where that's one of the differences between sort of mainstream scientific research and cryptozoological research is among amateurs, there's a tendency to try to hoard knowledge rather than share it. And that means that people duplicate the same work trying to find the same information. And it means that people can't build on the work that other people have done very easily. So I think anything the CFZ does to sort of promote that sharing through journal publishing, also just to build that network of people willing to do the work is a good idea. I have that problem where I'm a fan of the field, but obviously also critical of it, and because there are a lot of people out there who just sort of do the sort of echo chambery repeating of stories without actually digging in to find out what's going on. So when I saw your presentation at Crypticon, I knew we wanted to talk to you because you'd done such hard work and really what seemed to be rock solid research into the topic that you were looking at.
What is the topic? What was the topic of your talk?
It was called Bloodsucking Beasties and Shadowy Stalkers, and it was looking at cryptid attacks on livestock, but from the viewpoint of, like, purported vampiric attacks.
Okay. Right, and it extended far beyond just, like, cattle mutilations, for example.
Right, mm-hmm. or the chupacabra. I only talked about the chupacabra for maybe 10 minutes.
Right, right. So do you want to talk a little bit about what you found?
Yeah, so the first thing that I heard about, besides the chupacabra with this, was what's known as the vampire beast of Bladenboro, or the Bladenboro cat. And it's sort of one of those underground stories that a lot of researchers seem to be familiar with, but nobody's done a lot of, like, investigation into what actually happened. And so it interested me because I love vampires and I love the idea of a vampire cat because it's just fun. And what happened was in December of 1953 through January 1954, this small town of Bladenboro, North Carolina, had this rash of violent attacks on dogs, poultry, cats, sheep, so a handful of other livestock, as well as a rash of what were said to be Black Panther sightings. And the whole town panicked. Over 1,000 hunters over the course of a couple weeks started going into the swamps and the forests around the town with brandishing not just guns, but clubs and big sticks and whatever they could grab because they were panicking about these animals because they were worried that they were going to attack a child or someone else. They actually, at one point, outnumbered the town. There were so many hunters from other states and around just the state of North Carolina that were flocking to this town. And so that level of mass hysteria fascinated me, and I wanted to know more. I have mostly, as complete as I can get of a timeline of newspaper articles about this creature. And what's really interesting is, except for two examples, there was no real sighting of the Black Panther things around the kills. The only examples where that happened was on January 8th, a woman was looking at the sunset on her porch. And her dog got attacked by the large cat-like creature. And she said when she tried to shoo it away, it ran after her. Her husband came out with his gun and the creature just took off. But besides that, there were only kind of glimpses of a strange-looking beast in the outskirts when people discovered the animals that were killed. Now, the reason that people thought it was a vampire cat was because all of the animals that were killed in more or less the same way. It was pretty gruesome. They were their skulls were said to be crushed. Their jaws were ripped open. Some of them had their tongues removed. Others didn't. The animals were slashed on their sides. And, of course, they were said to be drained of blood. Sometimes there were puncture wounds on their neck. Sometimes there weren't. It would depend on the state of the animal at the time, whether or not there were, slash marks on the neck to be able to determine if there were puncture wounds there. And no one actually – there were no actual autopsies of the animals to determine whether or not they were actually drained of blood. It was just said that they were, because they couldn't find any blood around the animals. So it was just assumed that it was a vampire creature attacking them. Bladenborough is a really interesting little town. They actually hold a Bladenborough Beast festival every year, and I've been wanting to go down for a couple of years. I just haven't had a chance. But what's interesting is, unlike places like Point Pleasant that with the Mothman Festival, or Van Meter with the Van Meter Visitor Festival, Bladenborough's festival actually uses the creature to fund their band program for the high school, which I thought was kind of cool. And the Bladenborough case, it has a lot of tropes that are seen in other cases of these creature attacks that I really just kind of stumbled onto more of them. And I decided, hey, this would make a pretty good book.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about some of those tropes of some of the things that you see?
Yeah.
Go ahead, Karen.
I just wanted to ask a specific question about the panther sightings, because I'm from Australia originally, and we have a lot of those sightings there, big cat sightings and claims. And just in regards to the origins of these claims, they're not native creatures to Australia, but there are these different urban legends about how they came to Australia. Some say that they escaped from a zoo. And other claims are that they were brought to Australia by U.S. servicemen during World War II. So I'm just wondering if you've got the same kind of theme going here, either for the Bladenborough claims or for elsewhere, if you have different urban legends about the origins of these panthers and big cats.
Not really. The area where most of these attacks are is the eastern side of the United States, kind of the Mississippi is kind of the dividing line here. And after east of the Mississippi, that's where most of these attacks are. Mm-hmm. And when they're associated with panthers, generally they're said to be mad panthers, mad mountain lions. And despite the fact that they're said to be extinct, pretty much anyone you talk to, in these areas where I live, down in North Carolina, even up in Maine, will tell you that they're still here. Now, I'm not making a claim that they are, but it's very much a part of the rural culture that mountain lions are here. And the government doesn't want to admit it.
No, that's true. And I mean, the stories are out there, and there's always that government cover-up angle. I hear that over and over again in these online stories and in various places where I hear them, where there's coast to coast or different people calling in and telling stories. It's that angle that the government's trying to suppress it. They don't want us to know about these animals. I find that so interesting, like why there's that sort of conspiratorial anti-big government angle going on with it.
Bladenborough. No one ever actually, as far as I could tell, made a claim that it was a mountain lion, but panther is synonymous with mountain lion in the area. So just by calling it a panther, they kind of did say it might have been. But there were three or four bobcats that were killed in the area during the panic. And actually, there was an animal, a strange spotted cat that some speculated was an ocelot that was actually hit by a car at that same time. And I've been trying to track down whatever happened to it, but I haven't found a single thing concerning it. Also, there was an unusually large dog named Big Boy that apparently escaped a week before the attack started happening. And Zeke Stanton, the local who owned Big Boy, said that he fed the dog on nothing but blood and scraps from the local slaughterhouse, and he said that it developed a taste for it. So that was also one of the explanations that was being passed around.
What year was this again?
December of 1953 through January 1954.
Back to the exsanguination part of things. In your talk, you mentioned some things that I think are not said often enough about some of the reasons why an animal that's found dead on a farm might seem to have been drained of blood, but might not be. Could you talk about that a little?
I want to preface this by saying that I have done extensive research into what happens when an animal dies to the blood and the attack methods of these animals, of known animals. So even though I'm not a zoologist, I have done the research and I can back it up with credible sources. So when something dies, the heart stops pumping, the blood thickens, and gravity takes over and kind of pulls the blood at the bottom of the body where the center of gravity is. And this process is called lividity. And what happens is even if you like pick up the animal and move it around or, you know, even cut into the animal, you probably won't find blood because it's all pulled into one area. And I've read several interviews with veterinarians talking about this, saying how it can be incredibly difficult to actually determine whether or not an animal has been exsanguinated. So it, even if you're an experienced hunter or farmer or police officer, like most of the people who look at these animals are, they would not be able to tell whether or not the animal has actually been drained of blood. Another another factor that does contribute to the idea of these animals being these creatures being vampiric is many of these animals that will go out and kill livestock, domestic dogs, wild dogs, pretty much any kind of cat on the planet, and a handful of others, most of them will attack the throat. And there's a process, there's a behavior called surplus killing, in which a coyote or a wolf or most carnivores will start attacking animals when there's a high number of them, and they will just kill and kill and kill until the entire group is gone. And generally when these animals attack, they just get them in the throat and then move on. And I live right across from a farm, and doing research for my book, I went over there because I was curious. I wanted to know if just the average farmer knows about some of these things. And even though we have coyotes in the area and I constantly hear about coyotes attacking the animals, he was not familiar with lividity or surplus killing, because it is surplus killing is a rarer occurrence, but when it does happen, it can be devastating. I know of an example where a pack of wolves of like three or four slaughtered over 300 elk in just a handful of hours.
Wow.
Yeah.
Shocking.
In some of these cases, there's a case in 77 by Salem, Ohio, where 134 sheep were killed and by an unseen animal, just by a bite on the throat, in a single night.
Oh my God. And it must have been really difficult to count them. I mean, people kept falling asleep while trying to get the number. Sorry. No, but that is, you actually hit on something I really think is not underreported. I'm not sure what the right word is. The fact is that you can become a farmer. There's not like a high barrier to entry from an educational perspective. And there's nothing in farming training that's really all about, you know, here's what happens to your livestock after it dies. You know, keeping it alive, yeah, that's pretty common. But I don't think people really understand what happens when animals die. And there's a huge...
Not the average person, certainly.
Right. It's just, I mean, that's not your goal. I mean, your goal is to keep the animals alive, help them reproduce, get them to market or whatever it is. And there's just a lot of ignorance out there about what happens after animals die. And I see this again and again, where relatively mundane, normal postmortem things happen to creatures, and it completely confounds the general public. We talk about that on things like the Montauk Monster, where you have a mundane animal soaking in water, gets washed up on the shore, and it looks weird because the hair is off of it. So a hairless animal, suddenly it's a monster. No, not really. But to the general public, it looks unusual. You know, animals that are starved, you know, animals that are deformed. There's all kinds of really mundane things that happen that can transform something completely normal or within the spectrum of normal into something quite mysterious. And it's really, I think once people have embraced a sort of paranormal or unusual explanation, it's hard to talk them down from that. You know, if someone's convinced that there's a blood-sucking monster killing their livestock, it's hard to convince them, no, your livestock's dying, but it's something normal, you know?
Mm-hmm. I think that part of the reason that not many people know about what happens after animals die is because the topic is kind of taboo. It's mm-hmm. kind of gory and gross, and not a lot of people are comfortable bringing it up. I'm a little disturbed, so I think it's interesting. But I do when I do talk about these things, I do have to preface it during my talks that it can be a little gross, and I always try to dial it back.
Right.
even when it comes to food, we're so far removed from the way that animals are killed and our food sources, and you know, people used to butcher animals on their farms and just make use of all of the different parts of the animals, and nowadays everything's wrapped up in cling wrap in a supermarket, and so we certainly don't know about how animals are killed, how they die, and what becomes of them. It's not something people want to know about nowadays.
Well, and I think, Karen, you're or at least you have been a vegetarian, right? I don't know if you still are.
I grew up vegetarian. My mother is vegetarian, and so I've had periods of my life of being vegan, vegetarian. Right now I'm pescatarian, so I eat seafood, but not other different kinds of meat.
That's like Anglican, right?
Yeah. Episcopalian. It sounds religious.
It really does. I come from a family where, like, both of my sisters are vegetarian, and
really,
oh yeah,
in Georgia.
But my family has been farmers, ranchers, and so I grew up around the farm. I helped process animals, and I'm definitely a carnivore. Although I've experimented with vegetarianism, so I know
I didn't know that.
I'm capable of doing it. It's not my thing, but. Like John Cleese
deep
said,
fried okra.
If the Lord didn't want us to eat animals, why did he make them out of meat? I don't know. <It's> like, but the reason I say that is there are, in fact, I guess we'll probably have to slap an explicit label on this episode because we're going to talk about gross stuff. But a lot of the things that happen in some of these animal predations where a farmer comes upon his cow or his sheep and mysterious things have happened to it. I'm thinking about the cattle mutilation cases. They always talk about the anus being cored out, or the genitalia being removed, the eyeballs being removed, you know, like laser precision cuts, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
These are all the sort of things that happen during normal attacks by predators. That they go for the easy entry. Animal hide's tough. It's hard to get in there. With the peculiar exception of rabbits, I think, generally speaking, it's hard to skin an animal. I don't know why rabbits come up so easily, but they do. So eating, like, animals will eat out the rectum of a kill, and they'll tear off the genitalia, and then that'll dry out in the sun, or, you know, different things will tighten it and stretch it. As the animal gets distended by the gases expanding inside its body, they can change the shape of the wounds. There's lots of things that happen that are completely nasty to discuss, but which can lead to really peculiar interpretations by people.
I'm really glad you brought up cattle mutilations.
I thought you were going to say rectums being eaten out, because
I thought
no, gross.
Too.
That's really disgusting.
What's wrong with us?
Well, doing research on this topic and being very public about what I'm doing, because partially because I want to get some more recent attacks from people, because I don't have any. Almost all of the stuff that I have in my book that I'm working on right now is from newspapers or police reports or those type of first-hand stories that do have a lot of flaws in them. They don't always cover the right thing. They don't always have accompanying pictures. It can be really hard to determine what attacked these animals just from the vague descriptions in the newspaper. But people bring up cattle mutilations all the time. And it's something that I'm very adamant about not being connected, because just because it's weird doesn't mean that it has to be connected to this other weird thing. And in fact, they don't really have a lot of similarities besides an animal being dead. A lot of the times, the reason that creatures are being blamed is because they're either seen in the area at the same time, or there are clear signs of predation flat out that anyone can tell. Like they're bite marks instead of, you know, the apparent surgical cuts. Also, what really does make these appear to be weird is just the high level of animals that have been killed. There was a case in 1970, December, El Reno, Oklahoma. It gave us the great name of the Abominable Chicken Man. There was this anonymous farmer that was sitting in his home at night when he heard his chickens squawking out in his coop. It sounded like they were being attacked. So he grabbed his gun, went outside to go see what was going on. And the light in the coop was on. The door was ripped off and broken in half. And there were just feathers everywhere, but no birds. He had about 110 chickens in there, and they were all gone. What makes this weird, other than chickens disappearing, was that apparently on the ground there were these giant human-like footprints, and on the walls and the door there were bloody handprints. The farmer and the local newspaper sent photos of these prints to Lawrence Curtis, who was at the time the director of the Oklahoma City Zoo. And they also actually shipped him the door from the chicken coop, which I found interesting. Apparently, he actually kept the door in his office until he retired, which I just find quite amusing.
Yeah.
And Curtis was unable to determine what made them. He said that they kind of looked like a cross between a bear and a human, but he wasn't sure. He said they were definitely a gorilla and a human. Sorry. He said they were definitely not bear, but they were definitely primate. And that was about as far as he was willing to go. It was never really explained how, if this was a Bigfoot like people claim, it was never really explained how Bigfoot managed to steal 110 chickens within the span of a couple minutes. I'm pretty skeptical of the case because it was the farmer was anonymous, and there were not a lot of details given about the area and certain things. So it might have happened. I think it did happen, but I'm not sure if it happened in the way that the newspaper said it happened. And unfortunately, Curtis has passed on, as far as I can tell. So I'm just not able to get in contact with him.
Yeah.
For obvious reasons. But it does kind of show that the high number of animals that were purportedly killed or were missing was the weird factor there.
It's a peculiar case. When you talked about that in Kentucky, I thought that was it seemed like almost like fraud, because like that's a lot of chickens to go. So either the guys the timeline's wrong, or it's, you know, he's covering up something. Although I can't imagine he had chicken insurance. I don't
know. Yeah, I was thinking that too.
It's also one of those stories where it's been written about quite a few times. Lauren Coleman and Jerome Clark wrote about it in their Creatures from the Outer Edge. John Keel wrote about it in his Strange Creatures from Time and Space. Colin and Janet Board wrote about it. Quite a few people have talked about this case, but none of them expressed any kind of doubt that it happened, and none of them gave any other possible explanations.
Yeah.
I don't think that the question of how did a Bigfoot manage to get 110 chickens out of a chicken coop within probably 5 to 10 minutes.
Yeah. Hey, have you ever been around a chicken coop?
Yes.
Yeah, I have too. The very idea of trying to round up that many chickens at once as an animal seems absurd. I mean, you could get an animal, like if you could get a dog, a really hungry dog in a chicken coop, it could kill a lot of chickens really quick, but it can't get rid of them, right? That's a little peculiar. Right. Chickens are really good at getting away.
Yeah, it does sound like a mistake with the time frame.
Yeah.
But that's just on the surface of things.
And that's one of the reasons that it's really hard to use just newspapers for these kind of reports, because a lot of these newspapers are small town, so the only reason they're talking about this stuff is because they know people will buy it, and it's vaguely interesting, more interesting than who married who last Saturday. So oftentimes they'll play up things. Like, they'll play up, oh, it was a vampire, or, and 110 chickens were just gone, that type of thing. And, it can be really hard to determine what was, I hate to say falsified, but what was played up, or emphasized for effect versus, what actually happened. And, some details are just flat out left out, like, sometimes in some of the older newspaper stories, because I have things that go back to the 1870s, some of these stories, in a lot of them, women, if they're married, they won't actually have their own name. It'll be Mrs. then their husband's name. And it'd be really hard and really frustrating as a researcher, because I hate to just say that. Also, they'll call people by their nicknames. And just by their nickname, sometimes the last name won't even be given. So it can make it almost impossible to try to track down anybody.
Yeah, yeah. That's. I was looking at a newspaper that hangs on the wall in one of my favorite restaurants in my hometown. And they had like a 10th anniversary opening special. It was just like an ad for the paper, like for that restaurant that was 10 years after it opened. So this was, I think, 1955, and the restaurant opened in 1945. And then on the same page, they had all these other local news stories. And I, for some reason, while I was waiting for my order, I just started reading the other news stories. And it was funny what passed for news back then. So it was things like, you know, John Smith had a birthday party and his favorite kids arrived. And, you know, it was like the Parkinsons are having a visitor from out of town and she's going to be staying for a whole week. And I'm like, how is this news? How is this in the newspaper?
Exactly. Yeah. When I was doing research into the Silvercliff Cemetery, I was looking at a newspaper from the 19th century, and it was called the Wet Mountain Tribune, and everything was just like that, really mundane stuff.
Yeah, and then I think we've talked about briefly, it's not really one of our like regular episode topics, but the Great Airship Mystery, and then maybe like the Aurora, Texas UFO crash. Those newspapers at the time, they seemed to mix fiction and reality just absolutely seamlessly just assumed everybody who was reading it would know what was real and what's a tall tale. It was a different time. And I think there's been these this is a suspicion. I haven't actually done any formal research on this, but I suspect there's been rises and falls in the way that American journalism has pressed for accuracy, and then it's dropped away, and pressed for accuracy has dropped away. And as different editors come and go, I imagine there's pressure on that. But I think we actually probably need to do an episode on the sort of the role of journalism, because I feel like these Fortean topics and monster topics, they get short shrift in general. I think unless human beings are killed, in general, these stories are given like, here's a curiosity, here's a bit of news that we're never going to follow up on. You know, if you're a researcher 50 years from now, good luck with it, because we're giving you just enough to sell a newspaper and we don't really care what the outcome is. And they do the same thing on the news now. We talk about it a lot where it's, you know, here's a spooky story, here's a mysterious video, we're playing the X-Files music, and now we'll never know what it was, right? It just goes out right at the end of the show. It's just, that's mysterious, that's odd. And they always do this around Halloween too, where they play up a lot of, is it ghost, is it real?
Yeah.
You decide.
It's, oh, I hate it. I hate it. Oh my gosh.
I think... what's really interesting about these type of attacks is even more so than just the general monster story, these can get people riled up and get people working together. And that actually allows the newspapers to be able to cover it more generally. Some of these cases, it's like a blow-by-blow daily thing. Even if there were no sightings or attacks for a week, they're still talking about who went out on an expedition looking for this creature. And who did what, who freaked out about this, and then they'll just rewrite all of the encounters. And it's really interesting because it's unique in the sense that there's no other real level of constant reporting on these type of things. But then once people get tired of it, it'll just drop off and you'll never hear about it again. Mm-hmm. One of the other really interesting things about some of these cases is I'm not quite sure if it can be seen in other monster stories, but in some of these, I found that the creatures kind of are used as a backdrop for other conversations in the town. There was a case, oh man, I can't remember. I think it was in Massachusetts in the 50s. And there was a whole bunch of cat sightings, and a handful of dogs were attacked. But that wasn't as important to the newspapers as the factory workers that were quitting to hunt for the cat because they were upset that the dump across the street was smelling to high heaven because it was summer. So they decided to all quit their jobs temporarily and go and hunt for the cat until the stench went away. And that was covered 8 days in a row.
Wow.
There are so many unique aspects to some of these stories. There was another case in Granby, Connecticut in the 40s where the state Fish and Wildlife Director said that if anyone catches the panther, he would personally grill it and feed it to the first 100 people that show up to his house.
Wow.
And that case had a whole bunch of peculiarities. There were a bunch of teens that were out in one of the local wildlife preserves that were making out. And some of the boys had guns, and they were claiming that they were hunting for the cat that was attacking sheep and rabbits in the area. And they got arrested, and newspaper headlines said, Granby cat used as alibi for, I think it was canoodling teens.
Oh. That's pretty funny.
And that's one of the, while there are a lot of flaws with, you know, some of the how these stories are portrayed in the media, you also get some of the interesting sass and commentary on other things in the town using these creatures as kind of the way to get this discussion going. I think it's one of the more unique aspects of these things that you don't always see in other aspects of Fortiana.
Well, I have to say I commend you for bothering to go back to the original resources, you know, the primary sources wherever you can. There's so
not
many
enough people do that.
Well, that's true. And there's so many Fortean researchers who are basically just clearing houses for these stories, and they don't really filter them or evaluate them or do any additional work. And so I think you're on the right path here, you know, trying to get back to the primary sources, doing interviews if you can get in touch with actual witnesses, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So and applying some critical thinking to these topics. So what's your show like? I mean, if people wanted to check it out, what sort of things do you do? I've only had a chance to listen to one episode, and it was an interview with the guy who does Small Town Monsters, and I was enjoying that, but I didn't get to finish the whole thing before we got on here tonight.
Oh yeah, that was a crazy episode. Did you get to the point with the raccoon?
Yeah, that's actually exactly where I stopped. He's like, he was staying in a cabin in Tennessee, and a raccoon just showed up in the middle of the interview. Yeah. So
that's one of the beauties of doing live radio.
I surprised me. Well, you can't trust him because you've got this little bandit mask on. You know they're never no good.
My producer actually was on the call with us, like always, and she mutes herself to the broadcaster, but the entire time Seth was talking about the raccoon, she was going, "Watch out, it's rabies season, be careful." my radio show, The Crypto Kid, it's internet radio, which I think is getting bigger. I hope it does, because I love doing live radio, because I don't have to sit and edit, because I've done that before, and I just like letting things be how they are. It gives me a bit more of an excuse if it's lower audio quality.
Sure.
But The Crypto Kid started out as really kind of a way to have some of the top researchers in the field, some of the real movers and shakers in the field of cryptozoology, as well as skeptics and witnesses and other people, to come on the show and not really talk about cases or stories like a lot of places do, but to talk about ideas. Yes, we do talk about cases on occasion, but we really do that with a focus of, now what do these cases mean? What can we kind of get from these? What are some of the explanations for some of these creatures? What is the importance of Mothman? That type of thing. Like that, the whole cultural aspect and the ideas that don't quite get enough attention in the field anymore. I really try to focus on. And I also try to make it approachable for everyone. Not just people that are big into the field, because I think that it can be really hard to find a good show that is consistent in quality, that is easy to approach, that doesn't just tell stories all the time. And I have I've been really working hard on trying to get some of the biggest guests I can. I'm having Lyle Blackburn come on in a couple weeks to talk about some of the ideas behind the Southern Sasquatch. I'm having Sharon Hill, who I met at CryptidCon with you, Blake, to come on and talk about her book, Scientific Americans. And so I'm really focusing on some of the importance and, you know, why these things matter, and what are some of the ideas that that we can get from these things, as well as trying to be as objective as I can be, because I think it's important. And honestly, I don't know if any of these things exist, except for the thylacine. That's one of the few things that I will say I'm fairly confident it exists, but that's purely because I love it and I really want it to exist, and I haven't done a lot of like my own expeditions and stuff into it. I'm purely a fan when it comes to the thylacine.
We want it to exist too. It's a beautiful animal.
Yeah. Oh, incredible.
But I try to stay as objective as I possibly can. I think that's something that not a lot of other shows do.
So besides this work that you're doing with the CFC in your book that you're working on, I guess I'm curious about, what are you planning to do as far as like your education and career? Where are you? Do you plan to keep this separate, or are you going to try to find a job that works together towards like a common unified goal?
Well, see, I know a lot of people try to make their living in this field, and I respect those who figure it out, because obviously they're doing what they love, and I highly respect that. But I I honestly wouldn't be happy just working in this field, because I want to contribute not just to the field of cryptozoology and some of the more fringe topics, but I also want to contribute positively to science. I don't think I'd be happy just writing books on the weird and doing research into the history of some of these things, because I also have a drive to discover new animals and work with animals and discover new things about animals. I'm looking in right now into what the best education decision would be for me and some of the things I want to do. But right now it's looking like I'm either going to go into wildlife conservation or zoology, just as an overall field. I'd absolutely love to work with a zoo or work at a, work on a government level, working on trying to conserve some of the animals in these areas.
Well, I hope you're able to make that work out. That's you're young, you got plenty of time to figure all those things out, but good luck with it. And hopefully we'll get you some additional listeners. People can come check out your show. And when your book comes out, please let us know so we can help you promote it.
Definitely, I will. I hope to have it, the second draft, finished by January, and I'll be shipping it around the publishers in February. So by this time next year, I hope it should be out and people can buy it.
Very impressive.
Thank you.
And if you need help with a pun for the title or anything, let me know. My pun consulting business is working. I mean, it's going, it's moving.
I'll keep that in mind. If your listeners are interested in following what I'm doing, they can find me on Facebook. I have a page that is just crypto-kid. My website is paranorm101.blogspot.com, and my radio show is on every Monday night at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on WCJVradio.com.
And we'll put a link to all that in our show notes at monstertalk.org.
Excellent.
Yeah, and we'll just finish up with the usual question. So, Colin, what's your favorite monster?
Well, for the longest time, my immediate answer would be Bigfoot, because that's really one of the things that got me into this field. But now I think, looking at monster under the definition, under the assumption that it's a cryptid, I think I would have to go with the Eastern Cougar, because as I was looking into my book, doing the research for it, I really fell in love with big cats. And living on the eastern side of the United States, I really, really want a big cat or a large feline to still exist here. And I've been building a library on it, and it's a topic that I'm really passionate about, not just under the field of cryptozoology, but also wildlife conservation as a whole.
Well, you're at
Sounds
that
like
age.
Book.
Sorry, yeah, you're at that age now where you'll probably start running into a lot of Eastern Cougars if you go to bars.
Don't scare them.
No, Colin, it was great talking with you, and thank you for coming on.
Oh, yes.
I know we're very silly people, but I'll cut all that out. So.
I think you should leave it in.
we'll leave in some of it. So. Anyway,
it definitely was an honor to be on, and definitely filled a goal of mine of being on a not just cryptozoology shows, but a skeptic show as well. And I'm just really, really excited to have this come out.
Well, I think it'll be out. I believe, barring unforeseen obstacles, it'll be out next week. So I'll send you a link when it's up, and you can put a link out on your Facebook page. And I think this was a lot of fun.
I'm great
very
topic.
Impressed with your work, and I look forward to seeing what becomes of you. So this is cool.
Yeah, I think you're going to do a lot.
Yeah,
thank you.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk. I'm Karen Stolzner.
And I'm Blake Smith. Monster Talk is the science show about monsters. Today, you heard us talking with Colin Schneider, an investigator into matters bizarre and unusual. You can hear him on his radio shows Monday nights at 8 p.m. Eastern on WCJVradio.com. A link to his work will be in our show notes at monstertalk.org. Monster Talk is an official podcast of Skeptic Magazine. The views expressed on this show are those of myself and my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of Skeptic Magazine or of the Skeptic Society. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. There we have links to our Patreon pages as well as a donation button. A great way to support the show is to buy us books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle, and we can share our digital library with each other. Finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please, share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks again for listening, and thanks for everyone's support.
Did you know that you can now subscribe to Skeptic Magazine digitally? Just grab our free Skeptic Magazine app, currently compatible with iOS, Android, PC, Mac, Kindle Fire HD, and BlackBerry Playbook. Head over to skeptic.com/magazine/app to find out more, and download more of your favorite Skeptic content.
Colin Schneider is one of the youngest active 40 and cryptozoology. This is a new word to me, cryptozoology. I'll try that again. Is one of, I do these a lot, you know, this is like our 141st episode. I'm just getting the hang of it.